It's fun to experiment with things in the garden, but it's also nice to have an idea of what you're getting into when you plant something. Fortunately, Iowa State University Extension can help you out with that. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Every year, Iowa State University Extension holds field days at its home demonstration gardens, and everyone's invited to see what's growing and to learn how to grow it themselves. This hour, horticulturists Cindy Haynes and Laura Irish will tell us about what's featured at the gardens this year, and horticulturist Richard Duran will be here to answer your questions about the plants in your life. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled, and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and of course, it's always fun to grow something new. And Iowa State University Extension is a great source for information and ideas. One of the most enjoyable ways to get that information and those ideas is to go to one of the Home Demonstration Gardens Field Days, annual events put on by ISU Extension. We're going to find out all about them. Cindy Haynes is here, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
Laura Irish is also here. She's a master's graduate student in horticulture and sustainable agriculture and very involved with these gardens. Hello, Laura.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you for being here. And Cindy, give me an overview. We've talked about these field days before, but what goes on at a field day?
So every year we have a field day at one of the different several of the different ISU research farms. The home demonstration gardens are planted at 6 different ISU research farms this year. And at the field days, we invite the public to come out and see what we're growing, because we change the themes up a little bit every year. They can sample some of the things that we have, so they can taste some of these, you know, different types of tomatoes, or they can look at the different types of potatoes, or what's growing in the garden. And we give them a plant list. We usually have some other things that they can eat or try. So we might have popsicles at some of these field days this year. And then they can ask questions about how things are growing in their garden as well. So they get ideas with a plant list of things that they can put in their garden for next year.
And how do you decide what's going to be grown at the demonstration gardens?
Right. There are some parameters. Most of the plants that are grown at the gardens are annual plants. So we'll have a lot of annual flowers and a lot of vegetables. So, you know, there's usually a big vegetable and annual flower component. And we try and do things that are, we try and get plants that are available to the public. So we don't use, you know, really unusual sources. We're using, you know, a lot of the seed sources that you get, those seed catalogs that you get in the winter. So those are the things that can, some of those parameters. And then we try and do something new and different that might be kind of trendy, or like small space gardening is one of the themes this year. So we have some, you know, some more compact plants or plants that kind of grow up on a trellis or that work well in a raised bed. And then we, you know, this year and last year we have this link to the pantry garden, which is part of a SNAP-Ed kind of partnership with the Master Gardener Program and their ISU research farms.
Right, and we talked about that last year, but mm-hmm. it's continued to grow, no pun intended.
Right, and we'll take the pun.
All right. Donations of food from these pantry gardens has been really significant. What, over 10,000 pounds of fresh produce?
Yeah, so last year we had almost 10,000 pounds, which was our goal. And this year we're hoping to get a little over 10,000 pounds at the 6 gardens.
Right, and that's just at the 6 gardens. The demonstration garden project is one aspect of that. And how many pounds were through the mini grants that were donated?
It was over 63,000 pounds for the whole project last year.
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, Laura, I know this has been a real focus of your work, these pantry gardens. So describe one of the pantry gardens to me. What are you growing?
Oh, okay. I was actually just at the horticulture research station yesterday morning, and I helped one of our master gardeners harvesting. And so we have three different types of summer squash, which are very prolific. If you've never grown a summer squash or zucchini, you should try it. It's very gratifying.
It makes you feel very successful.
Yeah, you're like, I did it.
You harvested 100, how many pounds?
Almost 150 pounds yesterday morning, which Some of them were quite large, I will say that. But
but they're not 100 pounds squash.
No. All under 8 pounds.
Okay. Well, 8 pounds is still big.
Yeah, very, very big. We also have four different types of tomatoes that we're growing this year. We have four different peppers, different broccolis, cabbage. I said zucchinis. Can you tell? That's on my brain. I want some zucchini bread. That'd be great. Carrots, beets, onions, muskmelons, kale. Just a lot of different species this year.
And master gardeners across the state are helping out with these gardens?
Oh, yeah. Yep. So they are the ones who are harvesting the produce. They're taking data for us so we can promote the best cultivars for home gardeners if they want to grow for a pantry. And then they are also donating them to their local pantries, all the fresh produce.
Well, and Cindy, you had mentioned how much bigger this is than just the demonstration gardens. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like this is really catching on? Are a lot of people getting excited about the idea of growing produce for food pantries?
I think so. And at these field days where we have about 500 people that actually attend, that's one of the things that we ask is, you know, most of these people that attend have a garden and they almost always have excess produce that they don't know what to do with. And so we ask them, would you, you know, donate those to a local food pantry? And many of them aren't aware that many of those local food pantries will take fresh produce. So we promote some of these plants that we're growing in the garden because they maybe don't require as much refrigeration. They can hang out for a day or two on a counter and then be available and still be fresh for, you know, that local community.
Well, and of course, a lot of food pantries over the years have asked for shelf-stable items. Mm-hmm. Do you find that food pantries are becoming more open to this fresh produce as well?
I think they really have been. We try not to, you know, tomatoes and cucumbers and even the summer squash, they love it. And usually when we donate it to a food pantry, it is gone or taken or selected within the first, you know, 24 hours. It's gone the first day.
Sometimes it's gone in the first 20 minutes.
Wow. Now, and Laura, I know this has been part of your thesis project, doing the training and the surveying and working with master gardeners. What have you learned from the research you've been doing, and what do you hope to use that for?
So I've learned a lot in working on this project, and a lot of it for me is actually kind of personal. And of course, you know, we have data too, but I've been learning a lot of how rewarding it is and gratifying for the master gardeners. And so I've been working with them and talking with them, and overall the master gardeners who come back each year for the pantry garden are the ones that say, I love going to the pantry and donating this produce that otherwise could have been wasted. And so it's kind of that feeling that, you know, I never thought about that, how important it is for people to be contributing to their local communities in such a meaningful way. I've also learned that it is very difficult to hold trainings across the state, at least for me, to travel. I don't know how everyone does it, but it's a learning lesson for me.
Welcome
car rides.
To extension.
Yeah.
lots of time extending oneself.
Right. Yeah.
So, Cindy, we've talked about the pantry gardens. You mentioned mm-hmm. the small space gardening, which mm-hmm. is something that a lot of people have a lot of interest in because a lot of people just don't have a right. lot of space. And so your goal with that is to show how much produce you can actually grow in a small space?
I think it's a little bit of that, and it's a little bit of how big these plants are. So there are melons, there are, you know, cucumbers, there are zucchini that really don't require a lot of space that maybe you can even grow in a container or a cucumber that you can kind of trellis up. So it's or beans, you know, that you can do these things even if you have a patio or you just have a little bit of space that you can select things that you can grow. And they'll be very productive, still fairly productive.
Now, I talked a couple of weeks ago with Denny Schrock about edible flowers, and we mm-hmm. talked about a lot of different edible flowers. But you also have an edible flower garden this year?
Right. So this year, we always have flowers in the garden. So the aspect of the flowers side of things is new cultivars, some new and unusual cultivars, as well as some edible flowers. And Richard and I, and this is where I can pull in Richard a little bit, we were discussing, you know, there are some flowers that are edible, and then there are some flowers that maybe they're edible, they won't kill you, but they don't taste good. So,
yes, we kind of disagree on that.
Oh, you have different tastes on that one, huh?
So this is the kind of thing that where you can invite people to come out and you can try it, you know. So marigolds are considered edible, but we both agree that the little signet marigolds taste better than a regular marigold, which tastes a lot like it smells.
No. Yeah. And in the edible flower tasting, mm-hmm. are you just tasting the blossoms? Because a lot of people use these in many different ways.
Right.
We talked extensively about candying different blossoms.
Right.
Well, that's pretty different from just eating one.
Right, right. So, yes, you can candy anything and, you know, it tastes really good
right.
after you candy it. But, yeah, so we're just going to do a taste test of the flowers or the flower petals. And this is where I might put a few in popsicles, you know. So yeah, I made Richard have a popsicle this week, and yeah, he liked the lemonade, but you know, the flowers were a little
flowers
weird.
Were not so great.
Who put these flowers in my popsicle?
Right. So it's about how you use them and how they're used for decoration. Yeah, they're there to be attractive, and some are tasty, and you know that I find tasty, and then maybe you don't. So it's just the way it works. And when people come out to those field days, they can try for themselves and say, okay, yeah, I would include that. Or no, I think I'll just grow that one because it has a nice flower, but I'm not putting it in my salad.
Are yeah. there edible flowers that you eat on a regular basis, Cindy?
I do like, I like nasturtiums, and I like daylily flowers. I put daylily flowers in a salad occasionally, and I like nasturtiums in a salad because they're just a little bit peppery. So yeah, there and like chives. I like some of the flowers from chives as well. So there are a few that I would include.
All right. Well, we mentioned that there are demonstration gardens at the research farms around the state. So there are actually 6 different field days coming up. I've tweeted out a link to an article that talks about what you can do and what you can see at these field days, and also the schedule coming up. What, July 18th, July 20th, and then the first week of August. There's
right.
one on the 1st, the 2nd, the 3rd, and the 5th. Everyone can come to these?
Everyone. They're open to the public.
All right. And where is a good place to find more information, Cindy?
To go to that link that you just tweeted out. And you can also go to the ISU horticulture page. Look for the consumer horticulture page, and it's right there at the top as well as an announcement. This is also should have gone out as a press release in early July. So the link to that information is there. So
and they're free and open to the public. Mm-hmm. How long do people usually stay when they come?
Usually the field day itself is about an hour to 2 hours, hour and a half. Sometimes depends on the weather. If it's really hot, it's a little bit shorter.
I noticed most of them are scheduled for the evening hours. So.
And we try to schedule them in the evening after you've had, you know, supper so that it's a little bit cooler.
All right. Well, we are going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. With me this hour, Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Richard Duran will officially be joining the conversation in a moment, ISU Extension Horticulturist. And Laura Irish, thank you for being on the show today. Laura Irish is a master's graduate student in horticulture and sustainable agriculture. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. The number to call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you both for being here. We've already got a few people on the phone. And again, that number, 866-780-9100. Dennis is on the line first in Polk City. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I've been doing a space-saving thing the last couple of years where I grow potatoes in mulch.
Mm-hmm.
And then alongside the potatoes, I grow squash, melons, and cucumbers. And then after the potatoes come up, the vines, I train the vines and they all go over in the potatoes.
Oh, nice.
Is there any problem with that companionship?
There isn't until the time that you're ready to harvest. So because you've got to dig up those potatoes and then you've got to kind of spread that mulch around to kind of get to the potatoes. So you don't want to do any damage to the other vine crops because they're still being productive after the potatoes have essentially finished or are ready to harvest. If you can carefully manage that, it should be okay.
I grow them in thick mulch, mm-hmm. and then when I harvest the potatoes, I just go in there with a pair of gloves and pull them.
Okay, and then you can just put the mulch around the vine crops or whatever, or however you can get that. Yeah, that's fine.
I just leave the mulch down, but there's no problem with diseases or anything. Those growing like right all together, is there?
There shouldn't be. I will mention that crop rotation is pretty important, so that you grow these.
Yeah.
They can still be in combination, but in a different location each year, and it should work just fine. My only concern is harvesting those potatoes and making sure you don't damage the vine crops. And then sometimes the vine crops are really viney and they may kind of climb over the potatoes. So making that a little more difficult.
Well, yeah, I have a Tahitian squash that sets down roots.
Ah, okay. Yeah, so
have you grown that yet?
I haven't grown the Tahitian squash, no. But we've grown several different vine crops that do kind of root as they go. So, yeah.
All right. Well, Dennis, thanks a lot for your call. I hope that works out really well for you. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Next up, Rihanna in Fairfield. Hi, Rihanna.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a series of about 6 raised beds. They're about 18 inches high with wooden sides. My soil goes down 3 inches, which is why I went up.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is there's 2 maple trees. I didn't plant them, but there they are. And I think it's feeder roots, but roots are coming up into my beds, and it dries out the soil. It's very difficult to keep my soil wet because the roots, I think, are just drinking everything. And I was thinking of trenching in front of the beds to take out the roots, and I was thinking of putting something down, and I wondered whether lime or something in the trench that I fill back in with the soil, obviously I've taken out of the trench, to dissuade the roots from coming back into my bed. Suggestions?
I think what I would do is simply work up the soil in the beds every year, every spring, and that would basically destroy the roots that have come back into the bed, and I would do that on a yearly basis. I think that's probably the best way of doing it. Maples
but
are...
That takes hours to do that. It's very difficult to do that.
Yeah, maple roots are very competitive. And
they're very aggressive.
They
will quickly grow back into a favorable area. So it's a very common thing for them. They have very shallow roots. They're very aggressive. And
not a good shortcut there, huh?
I don't know of a good shortcut, no.
All right. Rihanna, thanks a lot for your call. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Tweet us at IPRTalk. Next up, Ben is on the line in Springville. Hi, Ben.
Hey there. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. What's your question?
We have about 2.5 acres that are all designated prairie, and there's a lot of scrub trees and whatnot back there that we need to clean up. But when we moved in about 3 years ago, we had coneflowers, black-eyed Susans, and now the whole almost completely taken over by wild parsnips. And it's a daunting task to pull those parsnips or even to chop them off at the ground after they seed.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, is that something that, how do you restore a prairie like that? Burning it or just one by one pulling those out by the roots, or how do you do that?
Well, you may want to check with your county conservation board. There might be a botanist there that might be able to help. You might want to contact somebody with the Iowa Prairie Network and see if they might have some assistance or some information that might be helpful. But It's a very nasty weed, very nasty.
And just removing it by hand is one way, but then that can be a little bit treacherous. And
right. You have to make sure your skin is fully covered when you do that.
Yeah. So that's a tough one. And I'm not sure burning, which many of the plants, prairie plants, will tolerate, but I'm not sure that they wouldn't come back. So that may not be beneficial.
Well, Ben, I know you're not alone in this struggle. I know that people who even work very, very hard to avoid herbicide use will use herbicides on wild parsnip because it's just so tenacious and dangerous. But good luck.
Yeah, and you have to spot treat it because you want to protect all those prairie plants, too.
It's another hobby to take up.
Yep, it is.
All right, best of luck to you, Ben. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Brian is on the line in Robbins. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your question?
Well, I was wondering, I have some apricot trees out back, and the leaves are completely covered with these little 1/8-inch nodules that stick up off the leaf, and I wonder what that might be.
Okay.
Sounds like a gall.
It sounds like a gall. Galls are fairly common on trees. Basically what it is, it's abnormal growth, typically caused by a tiny insect. And what they do is, as the leaves are developing, they inject a chemical into the leaf tissue. In response to that, the tissue then grows abnormally. So you have this gall on your leaf. They're very, very common on many trees, especially on oaks. They vary from very small to fairly large, as big as a ping pong ball. But as far as the tree itself, once they form, you can't do anything. It's not going to help to spray at that point. Typically, we don't spray. Most trees tolerate galls pretty well, so we typically just kind of ignore it.
So it doesn't affect the fruit production?
Well, it doesn't affect the overall health of the tree to a great degree. They're fine. The leaves are still functioning. They just have this abnormal growth. So the health of the tree is okay.
And they're like, 30 or 40 on each leaf.
Well, some galls can be very, very numerous where they're just covering the leaf. So it depends. Some years the insect does not do well for some reason, and we have just a few. And other years the insect does very, very well, and so we have numerous galls on the foliage.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Brian. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk, send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And here's an email question. This one's from Jean. Comfrey has overtaken one of my flower gardens. Is there a way to deal with it other than digging it out constantly?
Hand pulling is probably the best technique. There is Roundup that you can use as well as a spot treatment, but digging it up and pulling it, especially before it sets seed.
Yes, make sure you get it before it goes to seed. That's the key there, so that over time the seed population declines.
So, yes, we need to give lots of big rounds of applause to people for doing really nice stuff, but you got to keep doing it.
Persistence. And get them when they're small. Get them when they're small. They pull much easier when they're small.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty.
It is pretty. And yeah, it's it's very pretty. It's very attractive. But one or two is great, 50 or 60, not so great.
All right. So if this is a plant that you're like, oh, these are really pretty bell-like blossoms, I'd love to have this in my garden, you might want to think twice because it's tenacious.
It is a good reseeder. It's not a hard one to pull, but it is one that you think about. We have in an herb garden, and then we keep it in this one contained area. So, yeah. So it's one of those you often see in an herb garden repeatedly, but it has to be managed.
All right. Here is a question from Kevin. Richard, you often recommend 3 trees for the homeowner to grow. Locust and white pine are 2, but I don't recall the 3rd.
Well, as far as shade trees, I think the oaks, the maples, and the lindens are my top 3.
Okay.
As far as the evergreens, we're very limited as far as evergreens that do well in Iowa. So basically, it's the white pine, the Norway spruce, and the white or concolor fir.
All right, 2 lists of 3. Kevin, thanks a lot for your question. Let's go back to the phones. Frank is on the line in Newton. Hi, Frank.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, what's your question?
Oh, yeah. Hey, I got some tomato plants. I grew there's like eight of them in this row, but the two actually, it's almost drifting to the third one. They wilt, but they're not dying, and I've never seen that. It's almost like they go into shock, but they're not dying. But every once in a while, they'll come back and look normal, but most of the time, they're just kind of wilted.
Well,
I don't know what's causing that.
There may be a vascular wilt involved here. Either verticillium or fusarium, and it's a fungal disease. It gets into the plant via the roots and then slowly begins to clog the water conducting tissue in the stem. So initially you might see some wilting during the heat of the afternoon, but by early evening they recover. But as it becomes more and more severe, the wilting is more long-term, and eventually the plants usually die. So hopefully that doesn't happen, but a vascular wilt is a definite possibility. Most of your cultivars are wilt-resistant, but they're not immune to it. So hopefully it's not that. Another possibility would be if you have walnuts nearby, a black walnut. That can also cause wilting. So if you have one fairly close where the branches might actually reach the garden, that could be due to jug lung, which is produced by the walnut tree. And finally, we have an insect, a stem borer, that sometimes gets in there too, but that tends to be more permanent. So once that happens, it goes.
Okay. With that first one, with that vascular one, would it spread to the other plants?
Well, with verticillium and fusarium, it tends to be very sporadic. It just pops up here, pops up there. Other plants nearby may be perfectly fine. So it's hard to predict. There's typically no pattern to it.
Okay. All right, then. Well, thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Frank. What kinds of calls are you getting regularly these days? What's showing up, Richard?
Japanese beetles. A third of my calls the last 2 weeks have been on Japanese beetles.
Oh, wow.
So that's been the dominant thing, yes.
All right, so if that's not your problem, you just count yourself lucky.
Yes.
All right, Ben is on the line in Pomeroy with a suggestion for prairie restoration. Oh, hi, Ben.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What would you like to suggest? We were talking about a wild parsnip invading a prairie space earlier.
Right. I saw this on IPS the other night, actually. It's a company called Goats to Go. What they do is bring out a herd of goats, and they bring electric fence with them, and they fence it off in sections, and they can do large areas, acres and acres, if you'd like. But goats eat everything but grass.
All right. Well, we are seeing that happening a lot more. I know there were just goats at Ada Hayden in Ames not very long ago, and I know of a number of other places around the state where people have been renting goats. Is that something that you guys know very much about?
If you're talking about you guys as
far
as
you guys, the two of you.
No. Oh,
I'm
that's
not sure.
because they eat everything. So, you know, goats in a home landscape, they would decimate a landscape pretty quickly.
Right. Yeah, they can turn almost anything into a desert pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. But obviously it's great for taking care of invasive species like honeysuckle. So I'm not sure they'd work with wild parsnip, but it may be worth checking out. And if your neighbor has a goat, maybe you can borrow it.
Yeah. It's worth a try if you're not having to get out there in it. That's definitely worth a try.
All right, 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Thanks a lot for the suggestion, Ben. Here's a question from Gabby. And guess what, Richard? It's about Japanese beetles.
Okay.
She says, last week you talked about Japanese beetles, the biggest frustration of my summer. I read that 4 o'clocks, which are an annual flower here, are good because the flowers attract butterflies, but the leaves are poisonous to the beetles. I'm wondering if you've heard of this. This year my seeds did not grow big enough to make a difference. I'm wondering if the beetles will even notice if my linden tree is there for them anyway.
As far as that plant being poisonous, I doubt it very much.
Right.
All right.
That would be nice.
It would be nice.
A Hail Mary.
Yeah.
And the linden tree is so attractive.
Yes.
To the Japanese
and
beetles.
And birch. Yes. Yes.
All right. She also has a follow-up to the tree root question. She says, I have a 14-year-old locust tree whose roots are now starting to show in my yard. Is it bad that my husband drives over this with the mower? Should we bring in dirt and build that up over the roots?
I would just go over it. rather than cover it, because even if you cover it, that may be a temporary solution where the roots keep on growing, and within a few years they resurface. So I would just go around them and over them carefully and leave it at that. That's what I do in my yard.
All right. And here's a question about garden herbs, and this may not be your area of expertise, Cindy, but maybe you can point basil in the right direction. I think that's the name of the person.
Not
the herb, right. Okay.
That's nice.
How long should I keep my dried garden herbs? Do they have a shelf life? And as an example, a comfrey mix for medicinal use with lavender and bee balm.
Right. So a lot of the dried herbs, if you're storing them properly, kind of in a dry, kind of dark, cooler location, if you're storing them dry, they're usually pretty effective for at least a year. I usually try to, you know, any kind of herbs I'm using in cooking or for culinary purposes, I think they lose a lot of potency after that. In fact, we have some food scientists that say you should replace your spices every 6 months or so. So let's have that target of about a year so that you're creating new ones every summer and then storing them and then have another supply started the next year.
And do you have advice on how to keep them fresh? I mean, obviously, a lot of us have little spice jars.
And those are perfect. So if you have some herbs that you've dried, you can just grind them up and put them in your spice jars and then put them in your, you know, kitchen counters in that dark, kind of relatively cool place, just like your spices.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa with me, Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, and Richard Giron, ISU Extension Horticulture Specialist. You can join the conversation, too, 866-780-9100, or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and you are welcome to join us with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me today, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. And let's get back to the phones. Jan is on the line next in Granger. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Hey, this is not really a question. Well, maybe it is a question. Something was eating my hostas, and it was not slugs and snails, and I was seeing almost inch-long gray beetles and got on the internet, and I think they may be ash gray blister beetles.
They could be blister beetles, yes, they could be.
I was kind of glad that I looked that up before I stuck my hands in there, because apparently they have a very caustic.
Yes, they can. Right. So you can use insecticides, some of your common garden insecticides, but I would assume that the hostas can tolerate a little bit of damage and be just fine. So I think I would be more inclined just to ignore the damage at this point.
Yeah.
Because
it seems like the green and white ones are the ones they're completely, you know, defoliating.
Okay.
It's not just little holes in the leaves.
Okay.
It's they're eating. So
So then I would use a common garden insecticide, maybe 7 or 8. We normally consider those to be actually beneficial insects in that they eat the eggs of grasshoppers. But obviously sometimes when the populations are high, they can be annoying and damaging to plants too. So
do you to get the for them to have the caustic effect, do you brush against them, or do you have to squish them for that the stuff to be released to cause the skin damage?
You have to simply touch them. So you want to avoid touching them. So if you were to pick them off by hand, you'd want to have a glove on your hand, and then destroy it that way. So, but you
that
don't want to you
helpful.
You do not want to touch them with your hand.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Yeah, good luck, Jan. Thanks a
lot
for your call.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah.
Bye.
866-780-9100 is the number to call. Shirley is up next in Cascade. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. I'm actually calling for my brother. He's having problems with his tomatoes, and he usually has a great crop. And they're all, the leaves are curling up, and she's taking a lot of the curled leaves off, and they're not, you know, full, like, mine are doing great. And I was wondering if you knew what was wrong.
Well, it's hard to say on the phone. I mean, on radio, I would suspect it has a disease of some type. And you probably can't do anything for this year. So what I'd probably suggest is that this fall, when the plants do die entirely, that you pull them up, that you remove the debris as best you can from the area and destroy it. And then next spring, plant your tomatoes in a different location where they haven't been grown for at least a couple of years. So you want to rotate. At this point, as far as trying to control the disease, I think it's way too late.
Okay, well,
so he's going to be at your house getting tomatoes this year.
But hopefully,
I did plant extra.
Good.
But hopefully, those plants that are infected may still go ahead and produce a crop, a much smaller crop, but at least a crop.
All right, Shirley, thanks a lot for your call. And next, we've got Bob in Dubuque. Hi, Bob.
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I have a cherry tree in my backyard that is about 4 years old and was very healthy. When we had the nice weather in February and March, it started to bud out, and then I believe it got frozen because it did not leaf out at all. And I'm just wondering if there's a chance this will come back next year, or would it be kind of done?
No, it's done. If it hasn't leafed out this year, it's done. And I don't think it was the cold weather in March. Something happened to it. The buds form basically in late summer, and they basically sit there until the following spring and then break. Apparently something happened between last fall and this spring, and it died. So unfortunately, you'll have to replace it.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. 866-780-9100. Joe next in Mount Vernon. Hi, Joe.
Hi. See, I just got a quick question about these Japanese beetles. They pretty much destroyed several of my trees, and I was just wondering if those trees are going to come back and that next year. And then also, where do the beetles go in the winter? Do they go in the ground? Can I spray the ground or what?
Well, basically, if you have a well-established tree that's been there for several years or more, they can defoliate it, but they're not going to kill it. And so I wouldn't worry. So the trees should come back next spring. As far as if I had a younger tree, maybe in the ground, maybe 2 or 3 years or less, then I would probably spray it to control the insects, because a young tree can't tolerate that type of damage. Older tree definitely can. As far as what they do, they mate. The females lay their eggs in the soil, and then you have these larvae or grubs in the soil, and they feed on the roots of the turf grass plant. They stay there until basically next spring, and then they turn into adults, and then the adults emerge from the ground typically beginning in mid to late June. And they're typically around for 30, 45 days, eating things constantly, things like lindens, birch trees, roses, grapevines, etc. So they have a certain number that they really like, and if they're present in large numbers, they can defoliate some trees very quickly. As far as treating your lawn to control the grubs in your area, you can do that, but it's not going to impact the population of Japanese beetles next year. And that's because your treated landscape, your treated lawn, is just a small speck in the overall landscape. And these insects, the adults, are very able flyers. So they're going to fly in from adjacent areas. So even if you treat your lawn, you're not going to impact the population next year. The weather will, but you can't.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot for your call. And here's another question about Japanese beetles. A lot of people are looking for answers. This one's from Sheila. She says, do nematodes work to control Japanese beetles?
Not very well. But again, even if you could do that, it's not going to impact the population overall. So,
and explain the idea. How would you use nematodes?
Well, there are some nematodes that, in theory, if you apply them to the ground, that they would be parasitic and they would destroy the grubs in the soil. In theory, that sounds great, but you don't get very good control using them. So If I was going to do it, I'd probably use an insecticide. But in the case of Japanese beetles, it doesn't really affect the population next year. So you're really not accomplishing much.
Right.
Unless you're trying to protect your turf.
So the same answer you just gave Joe,
right.
However you might treat your lawn,
right.
It's not going to make a difference with the Japanese beetles next year.
Nope.
All right, here's a question from Sarah. I have a Honeycrisp apple tree. It's 7 years old. It didn't do well last year. Leaves fell off early last year. This year it has tons of apples, but the leaves are light yellow and limp looking. She's wondering if the citrus mulch she put under it last year for weeding prevention and aesthetics might be affecting the health. And she also wants to know if it's okay to spray the tree to protect the apples from bugs now.
Well, if the apples are still in good shape, you can spray now if you need to. But if they're already damaged, it may not do any good. As far as the cypress mulch, I don't think it's affecting the tree itself. Now, what I would have done is earlier in the spring, if it's loaded with fruit, you need to remove some of those, hand thin some of those fruit, because otherwise you're overtaxing the tree itself. And so I would have taken out some of the fruit, and when you're done hand thinning, there should be about an apple every 6 inches on a branch.
Is it too late for her to do some hand thinning now?
I don't think it's going to do a whole lot of good at this
okay.
point. But next spring, she might want to go ahead and fertilize lightly with like a 10-10-10 fertilizer. That wouldn't hurt.
All right. And next spring, although apple trees tend to kind of
yes.
be every other year
because
anyway.
Because of the heavy crop this year, I doubt that she's going to have much next year.
All right. So maybe she doesn't have to worry about thinning next
nope.
year. But if there are a lot of apples, she should thin.
Yes.
Okay.
Within 30 days of bloom.
All right. Let's go back to the phones. Maggie is on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Maggie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually have a couple of questions. One is we have a wood panel fence, and I wanted to plant a vine plant that would maybe go over the fence a little bit. But I was told that a lot of vine plants will actually damage the wood. Is there like a best choice? And the other question is, I was told that if you pluck the flowers off of the tomato plants when they start in the beginning, that they'll actually grow bigger and produce more fruit. So,
okay.
I guess I'm curious about what vining plant would be best for
mm-hmm. right.
not damaging a wooden fence.
Tackle that one first. A vining plant that would not damage a wooden fence.
Well, there's a lot. So you could do clematis. That would be a good perennial vine. We're looking for those vines that kind of twine on something and then don't necessarily affix to
right.
anything.
And so you may have to provide some type of support
mm-hmm.
to get on that fence, maybe a little bit of wire or maybe a little bit of fencing.
Just to get them started.
Right. And for example, sweet autumn clematis is a mm-hmm. very, very vigorous plant. Does very, very, very well easily. Other suggestions?
Are there vines she should avoid? Would that be an easier way?
Maybe that's an easier way to take
yeah.
it. So there might be some things that I would avoid, like a Virginia creeper, because it has the ability to affix to a fence that's hard to remove. And then there's some vines that get really big that might get a little too weighty. So I think about
trumpet
vine is first, the campsis, and then maybe even sometimes a wisteria can get really big and thick. That we could almost break something that isn't sturdy enough. And your fence is probably sturdy enough, but some of these need almost a steel post to kind of hold it up. Anything else, Richard, you would say to avoid? Or you could also go with annual vines, too. I mean, like, you know, morning glories, so that you know that they will die and you have to replant every year. So they will not do any damage to a fence.
The main one to avoid would be Virginia creeper, because
mm-hmm.
that really is nasty and it's hard to remove. It keeps everything so wet that things tend to deteriorate or rot. So definitely not good for a wooden fence.
All
as
right. And the second question, picking blossoms off tomato plants.
Right. If the tomato plant is quite small and it blooms and it starts to form fruit, you may want to pick those off just so that most of the energy goes into additional growth. Oftentimes, though, when the plants are small and they bloom, the weather conditions are not very favorable and they don't set fruit. But if they do and the plant is small, you might want to pick off those first fruit.
Which is hard to do. But
yes, heartbreaking.
But you don't pick off all the flowers because that's where your fruit comes from.
All right. let's go to Jim now in Johnston. Hi, Jim.
Hi, good morning. We have some river birch trees that are starting to lose their leaves. I'm just wondering if there's something that we can do.
Okay. Are they turning yellow? Are they turning brown? Because I could see two things possibly.
The leaves, some of the leaves look healthy on the tree. Some of them are turning yellow, and then they drop to the ground.
Okay. Two things may be occurring. One is the river birch likes a moist soil. That's where they're native to. And when we have a long, hot, dry period, some of their leaves will turn yellow and they will fall off. It's basically the tree's way of dealing with the hot, dry conditions. They shed some of their foliage. So that's pretty common. The other thing that we're also seeing on birch is the leaves turning brown because they've been eaten by Japanese beetles. So if you have leaves on the ground that are brown and much of the leaf tissue is missing, that's due to the Japanese beetle. So it could be the heat and dry conditions, or it could be the insect.
But either way, there's not a lot Jim can do.
Right, right. With the tree, as far as if it's heat and drought, and the tree is not huge, I would consider watering it. Yes.
All right, Jim. Thanks a lot for your call. Joanne, next in Muscatine. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. We have bought a place, and I believe this property was in the 70s, and there's some wonderful hibiscus trees that bloom about this time of year. The blooms are about the size of a big baseball, but it's not doing too good. How do I prune it or groom it a little bit of haircut or whatever so that will be nice?
Right. It's probably a rose of
Sharon. Am I saying it right?
Yeah.
Oh,
you, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a hibiscus. It's probably a rose of Sharon or an Althea shrub. And they do have, you know, nice, attractive baseball-sized flowers in pink or purple or white. You can prune those. The best time to prune those is probably during the dormant season, so you can take a look at the branches. And you're going to remove, you know, some of the branches, about a third of them, or cut it back just a little bit, and then do this over a several-year process so that it kind of comes back a little bit shorter, a little more compact, and a little more vigorous. We call this renewal pruning, where you're taking out a little bit every year for 3 or 4 years. And that way you can see when you're doing this in midwinter or early spring before it leaves out.
All right, let's squeeze in one more call. Julie's on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Julie.
Hi. Okay, great. I'm glad you guys could get me in. I'm going to talk fast. I'm getting ready to move. Mm-hmm. I currently live in Des Moines. I'm moving to a suburb. I have a large garden right now, and I want to try to take as many plants with me that I can. I have a lot of hostas, some bleeding hearts. They're in, you know, various stages of growth.
Mm-hmm.
Trillium, coneflower, spiderwort, poppies, right. Bees balm, peonies. And I don't, because they're in various stages, I know that it's not the right time to move them. Right. I'm wondering what the best way is to do this.
Well, you can divide or try and take little divisions of things and put them in containers and move them when you move. You'll have to keep them watered, and you'll have to kind of baby them a little bit. And you'll have to baby them, you know, even after planting for a few months, actually, in the garden that you're planting.
I was going to say, if you can't replant immediately, I would put them in a shady location out of the wind, keep them well watered, and they should be okay there for a while if you can't put them in immediately.
The ideal time to do this would probably be late August, early September, so you're not that far off. You just got to make sure that you keep a healthy plant and move it, and if you can replant it as quickly as possible, that it will be better.
All right, Julie, thanks a lot for your call. Good luck with your move. I'm going to ask one more fast question from Sam. I grow onions every year. I have one question. When the tops lay down, are the onions done growing, or should I leave them in the ground until the tops start dying?
When they fall over, typically at that point you can harvest them because they're no longer going to grow as far as the bulb size.
All right. Richard Giron, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron. Cindy Haynes, thank you.
Thank you.
Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Again, those demonstration garden field days are coming up soon. You can find the link at IPR Talk on Twitter and find out more about where you can visit a field day. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.